Welcome to KABU, Rachel Donito.
Thanks for having me, Jan.
Well, I appreciate you joining me on the Old Mole today to talk about your gripping new book, Eco Disasters in Japanese Cinema. You're a professor of Japanese literature at the University of Oregon and have published extensively on representations of nuclear issues in film, literature, and popular culture. As editor of this new book, you begin the introduction with an intriguing pitch. Japanese cinema, you say, is known for its spectacular scenes of disaster, unquote. Well, I want to focus today on some of the chapters on nuclear anxiety and disasters, but let's start with what Japanese cinema offers as commentary on eco disasters. What would you say is kind of the broad arc of that claim?
I think broadly speaking, the Japanese cinema offers a number of different things. So it offers something specifically for people in Japan who've experienced the atomic bombs, the Fukushima nuclear disaster, right? Other instances of industrial poisoning. It speaks to those people, but it also isn't, what I like about it is it's not just about Japan, right? These are environmental disasters that affect all kinds of people around the planet. So I think there's a way to read the films that we try to do in the book to talk broadly beyond just Japan problems and allow us to think more about what does it mean to experience environmental problems from, we're really thinking about the 1950s up until the present day.
Yeah, and I was particularly interested in how many of the contributors weave stories of horror, ongoing set of horror stories, with resistances and activism and forms of movement building around these disasters, which I think is often missing in the whole disaster genre. You mentioned the Japan's history of as victim of atomic bombing by the US of Hiroshima and Nagasaki in 1945. You also open with a lesser known part of the history of US occupation of Japan with nuclear testing in the years that followed and the propaganda campaigns and how the US governed a lot of the discourse about nuclear and what you call the good atom and the bad atom. We're seeing that, of course, have seen that elsewhere with nuclear power. Can you talk about the one example I think listeners are most familiar with, which is the Godzilla monster films, most well-known genre that clearly evoke the history of the atomic bombing of Japan. What can you say about that genre? Hibakusha films is the genre.
So this term hibakusha is a term that's used really specifically to talk about victims of the atomic bombings, but since then has been broadened out to be used more widely for any kind of victim of nuclear exposure, right? And the Godzilla films, the initial film sometimes gets not quite the credit it deserves because looking back on it now from the 21st century, the guy in the big rubber suit seems a little bit, less, not what quite what we're used to in terms of high-tech CGI,
That
right?
was 1954 version.
1954, but it's important to go, if you go back and watch that film was really traumatic for viewers in Japan when it came out because there is reference in the film to the atomic bombings, verbal reference in the film, and then there's also visual images that clearly evoke the atomic bombings. And it's said that when viewers were in the theaters, they came out of the theaters in tears after watching that Godzilla film because the imagery is so powerful, and there's so much war imagery in that film too, as they're battling this monster, right?
And that was such a recent collective trauma of enormous
Exactly.
magnitude. And so audiences knew how to read it. It was not only operating on a metaphorical level or symbolic.
Not at all. I mean, it's, less than 10 years had passed since the atomic bombing. So I think it, just the memory of the atomic bombings and then all the trauma of the war itself was very much packaged in that film. And it hit viewers on a really emotional level in a way that I think now we've kind of lost that sense of impact that the initial film had. And the films went on to be this incredibly lucrative, franchise, right, for these monster films that at different points in time has revisited in a little more depth the nuclear issue. But I wonder sometimes how much your average Godzilla fan knows about the initial, right, inspiration for the films. And if I can just one other quick comment, the film was re-edited for an American audience. I don't know how widely this is known, but the original Godzilla film was re-edited. They edited Raymond Burr into the film as an American newsman who was in Japan observing this monster attack, and they edited out the dialogue about the atomic bombs. That film became then really popular in the US, and then it was re-imported back into Japan. It was really popular in Japan again.
So you also talk some in in your, I think it was in your introduction as well as your own chapter on representations of Japan in American films, and Japan is this very lush, somewhat idyllic but kind of primitive forest, a kind of paradise. Can you say something about that? You also talk about representations of nature in Japan as it comes to embody nature, both its fearsomeness with earthquakes, and the terrain is also has a kind of mystery to it and a foreboding aspect as well as arresting beauty. Can you say something about that part of your thesis and how Japan gets represented in American films?
Yeah, so I think the Japan's representation in America's films really peaked in this kind of golden age of Japanese cinema in the 1950s. And that wasn't just America, but really globally. Japan was winning international awards. And a lot of these films are period pieces, so they represent a Japan from the, hundreds of years earlier. They're set in these rural settings, and they tell these kind of sometimes fable-like tales, right? Those films by famous directors like Akira Kurosawa went on to win international awards and I think set the stage for this image of Japan as this place that where people lived in harmony with nature, right? And Japan was also promoting that view too. And you see it in kind of GI films that followed again when Technicolor came out. So it's interesting to contrast that to this idea of Japan as a place that, what we argue in the book, really actively pursued a war on nature, right? As they, went through industrialization, right? As many countries have, right? And a kind of war on the environment. And you can see all this environmental harm in a number of these films. So the book was an attempt to help viewers see both of those images. And in some ways to allow us to kind of look underneath this image of Japan as this beautiful place of nature and harmony, and think a little more about what happened as Japan was progressing and modernizing, and what were the negative effects on nature and on the people in Japan.
So, and you do take that up with Fukushima and the revisiting of the horrors, the return of the repressed, in a sense, of the horrors of the nuclear project and atomic weapons that move into, atomic power, nuclear power. How do you describe, as you've taken it up, and I think in the opening and the conclusion of the book, that the atomic legacy, going from, what you call the bad atom or the bad nuclear to the good nuclear, where nuclear power tries to offer a kind of redemptive story of the destructiveness of atomic power, but also that redemptive story exploded massively with Fukushima.
Absolutely. And so in Japan, we talk about the myth of safety that was surrounding these ideas of nuclear power. As you mentioned earlier, the US government persuaded Japan to import nuclear power soon after the war, but very much, plants start getting built in the 70s, early 70s in Japan. And there is this idea of there's atomic weapons, and there's nuclear power, and nuclear power is safe. And this, it was seen as safe, cheap energy that was necessary for Japan to modernize after the war, and the nation bought into it in many respects. And so that myth, as you said, absolutely shatters when the Fukushima plant explodes. Because unlike the atomic bombs, when you could blame the Americans for dropping the bombs, who are you going to blame for the Fukushima disaster except themselves, right? The Japanese could only blame themselves. So it is this important moment of an awakening. Many authors and critics talk about, opening their eyes to how could I not have realized this? We were in this situation. Japan was the third most nuclear-friendly nation on the earth.
Yeah, which
And
always
so
seemed puzzling.
really
Yeah.
puzzling, like what happened in that moment? How did this kind of nuclear amnesia take hold,
Yeah. I
right, in
mean, some of it
Japan?
was the US occupation and the propaganda and the constraints on Japan, but you're saying there are other dynamics that are not reducible to that, or it's overdetermined maybe in a complicated way.
Yeah, I do think this the post-war economic miracle, as they call it in Japan, something had to power that economic miracle, and nuclear power provided this really cheap source of energy. And I think a lot of people were willing to kind of look the other way and enjoy this prosperous lifestyle while, willingly forgetting the costs of nuclear in Japan. And that all fell apart in 2011.
So how is that represented in films? Are there particular films that come to mind that kind of capture some of those shifts? Since Fukushima, there's I think less focus on how that gets expressed in films versus the atomic bombings, where there are a lot of films and there's a lot of literature on films related to that over quite an extensive period of time, but not so much films that deal with more contemporary environmental disasters, including Fukushima.
So there are a number of ways in which contemporary film deals with the Fukushima disaster. One are documentary films that are really interested in on the ground kind of work, interviewing people in the affected area, how they're going to continue to live their lives now that their homes, their livelihoods have been irradiated, right? And those are really important films. There are other films that show people, as you mentioned earlier, activism, fighting against, the push to have a nuclear power plant in their backyards. And then there are films like, to go back to Godzilla, Shin Godzilla, this film that came out after the nuclear disaster that kind of imagines Godzilla through these new nuclear metaphors coming out of the power plant accident.
What's the name of the film?
It's called Shin Godzilla, Shin. Yeah, and it's in the chapter about Godzilla mentions that film.
Is that available for people
That
to
should be,
find?
yes, that should be easy to find. Yeah, that should be easy to find. And at the end of the film, Godzilla is left standing in the middle of Tokyo and he's frozen because they inject him with this freezing solution and they don't know when or if he's going to wake up. So people have read it as this metaphor for these nuclear power plants that are trying to decommission or trying to shut down or trying to cool them down, but the danger is still really present. So that film does an interesting take on the ever-presentness of the danger, and our inability to look away.
Yeah, and the call to awaken to what is driven there and here by the very aggressive forms of capitalism and the harnessing of nature in the most brutal short-term exploitive way. Does that become part of the activism there, or is it fighting one monster on each corner, which often is what you have to do, because there are so many of them, but it's also part of a larger system. Is there that kind of reach to any of the activism, looking at, what kind of political economy have we built and participated in?
There was a huge just outpouring. There have been sort of slow and steady anti-nuclear movements since the atomic bombings, but this huge explosion of anti-nuclear activism after the Fukushima disaster happened, and almost a complete reversal of support for nuclear power. Whereas you'd previously had, 60, 70% in favor of nuclear power, you had 60, 70% against nuclear power. And then what happened, thinking about capitalism and global capitalism, the war in Ukraine made energy much more expensive in Japan. So importing liquid nuclear gas, right? Importing oil became much more expensive. And then you saw a shift in Japan that people decided, oh, maybe we should restart those nuclear reactors, right? And then again, interestingly, just about a year ago, there was an earthquake in Japan, and people that really kind of shook people up. And numbers started rising again in terms of, hey, wait a minute, maybe we should put the brakes on this nuclear program. Maybe we shouldn't be restarting those old reactors. As you know, these reactors are all really old, right? Built in the 70s and 80s. So it is shifting in interesting ways. It's difficult because the media always doesn't give it the kind of coverage it needs. The government is very pro-nuclear, so it's an uphill battle in the same ways it is here in the US.
Yeah. So in closing, tell us how to find your book. And I also wanted to put in my own personal pitch for it. I mean, it's a very scholarly book, beautiful scholarship, clearly serious thinkers who are contributors, but it's also a very it's a great read, full of insightful commentary, fascinating examples, and many of the films are available, as you said, but even for the more obscure ones, it's still interesting. I found the line of eco-criticism that you pursue very fulfilling. So that's my pitch at the close.
Thank you so much, Jan.
Tell listeners how to find the book.
So if people want to go on the internet, and you can search for Asia Shorts, Columbia University Press, and you can find the book through their website. You can also just put the title in and search it through Google, and you should come to the website of the publisher, is the place I'd recommend people go.
Eco disasters in Japanese cinema. Well, thank you so much, Rachel DeNito, for being with us today. And I know you have a new book that's in process. I look forward to reading that and having you on again to talk about your work.
Thank you so much for having me, Jan.